welcome to the Wage Indicator Podcast, a podcast where we highlight developments, best practices, events, research and more on global issues on the gig economy. My name is Martijn Arets and I am your host today. Platform work is a global phenomenon. What is happening where? What are the most common challenges for workers? And how can policymakers and worker representatives make a difference at a local, national and global level? These are the questions at the core of my conversation with Lena Siemet, Senior Advisor in the Human Rights Watch Economic Justice and Rights Team. Because we had so much to discuss, I decided to split the conversation into two episodes of the Gig Work Podcast. In this first episode, we explore the context of the gig economy and discuss cases from New York, Lebanon and Texas, where we talk about the conditions of platform work, how platform work is changing markets that were already precarious, and what policymakers at the local level can do to improve the conditions of workers. In the next episode, we will discuss the more global perspective, focusing on the ILO Platform Work Convention. Enjoy listening.
Hi, Martijn. My name is Lena Siemet. I work as a senior advisor in Human Rights Watch's Economic Justice and Rights Team, which is essentially the team that looks at economic issues and how economic and social policies affect people's rights. So that includes a range of issues from corporate responsibility, so the policies and practices of companies and their impacts on human rights, as well as public services, so from health to education, as well as social security and labor rights. And sort of those are the two areas that I mainly focus on in my work.
And in your work, so where does your motivation and your curiosity comes from?
I've had a long-standing interest in inequality and sort of what drives economic inequality within countries, but also between countries. And I think some of that interest was sort of shaped by the context I grew up in. There was always a lot of political discussion in my household. I grew up in Germany. And I then spent, as a teenager, some time in Nigeria, where my father was teaching, and sort of was confronted with these stark differences in standards of living and also in terms of inequalities, which then sparked my interest in understanding more what drives these differences, sort of between historical drivers, of course, colonialism, but also more extractive institutions and industries within countries, which is then why I focused my studies and my PhD on sort of investigating determinants of inequality. And within those, I found that social policy and labor rights are quite significant in sort of shaping the ways we live, sort of the services we have access to, ensuring that we have protections when we lose work or in older age or if someone has a disability. So there's sort of state institutions and structures in place that prevent people from falling into poverty. And so many countries don't have adequate systems in place. And so I wanted to learn more, why is that, and how can we also push governments to adopt more human rights aligned programs and systems. So this is how I ended up working for Human Rights Watch as an inequality researcher, and then over time transitioned to sort of focus more on broader economic justice issues.
A really interesting journey you have. That's good to hear. And so today we talk about the challenges and solutions for the gig economy. So we're going to really focus on platforms and labor. And also for the structure, we're going to start first with some more local and national examples also from your work. And then we take a more global perspective, also including the ILO Platform Work Convention. In fact, we met earlier before at the Wage Indicator webinar, Living Not Surviving, Living by Yourself for Gig and Platform Workers, where you also presented some of your work. And I'm really looking forward to follow up to this discussion we then had. So then we had, I think, 5 minutes, and so now we have lots more time to discuss. So my first question, so why do you think this topic of gig economy, so labor and platform, is so important? And what are the elements in the discussion that inspire and motivate you to focus on this topic? Can you also give us some more context around that?
Yeah, no, thank you for the question. I think I first got interested and started researching the topic of platform work during the pandemic. So during COVID-19, we saw more people use platforms to fulfill any sort of services they may not want to do or could do themselves. So whether that's food shopping, so grocery delivery, ride share, or other sort of household related tasks. And there was a lot of sort of celebration during the pandemic in terms of, you know, it's wonderful that we have these workers and we should be, you know, really grateful. But then what we saw is that many of them were really not treated well by the companies that hire them. So we saw that many weren't provided with the safety equipment, such as masks, hand sanitizers, etc., that workers don't have sick leave, meaning when they fall ill, they wouldn't be able to stay at home and recover, but they were still forced to go and work. And so we wanted to learn more about the structures that force people to be in these exploitative working conditions and what could be done about it. And at the same time, so this was, I guess, about at this point, you know, sort of 5-6 years ago that we started looking into this. And at that point, we also saw platform work really grow in numbers. So not only in Europe and the US, but also in other countries and regions, where more and more workers across different types of work are starting to be hired through apps and platforms, right? Sort of the more classic ones that we all know and probably have used are sort of the kinds of Uber and Lyft and Bolt that sort of replace taxi type services. Then I think food delivery is also an extremely common one. But now we also see different types of sectors dominated increasingly by platform work. So there was a really interesting study done on nursing and hospitals that now hire so hospital staff through apps on demand. So instead of hiring them as employees with specific shifts, it would be sort of on request for maybe particularly busy times. We see something similar also in teaching and education, sort of more on-demand jobs, as well as other types of healthcare, sort of in psychotherapy and other professions. So there's really a growing part of the workforce that is now engaged, sort of hired and fired ultimately through platforms. And it's sort of the Wild West now at the moment, where there's very little regulation in place. And many or essentially all of the labor rights that have been fought for and achieved in some ways in sort of the traditional employment models don't exist, right? Because of the labor and business model that these companies have created for themselves. So seeing how an increasingly large share of the workforce is exposed to platform work and then seeing the implications, them lacking labor protections, and that in itself reinforcing many of the inequalities that we already see in the labor market, is why we think it's a critical issue to pay a lot of attention to on behalf of policymakers and governments.
And do you also see, because those occupations, they are not new, especially also not in the to-consumer market, let's say delivery, taxi, domestic cleaning, do you also see this platform work, gig work, also as a kind of a opportunity to focus on the categories of workers that are ignored for ages in many discussions? And now, because the challenges of the platform work are also combined with their situation, it gives also an opportunity to get attention for this group of workers who are in many cases also were quite precarious before.
No, absolutely, absolutely. I think we need to be careful to say that everything was good before the platforms arrived, and that sort of the sectors where people worked in function really well beforehand. I don't think that's the case. I think there was quite a lot of informal work in these areas, and it sort of continues in a very informal way of organizing labor. And yet it's sort of, you know, through these large tech companies. But what is different is sort of the bargaining powers that workers have within the sectors. So if you think about, let's say, motorcycle taxis, especially in countries with larger informal markets, right? So take Kenya, where most motorcycle taxis are probably informal. There used to be some sort of agreement among the taxi drivers of how much a certain ride would cost, right? And ultimately, the price could be determined by the worker themselves. So bringing you from, you know, sort of the main market of Nairobi to one of the suburbs is going to cost you X amount of shillings. But now the worker doesn't have that autonomy anymore, or sort of that influence on the price, because the price is determined by the app. And since many of these companies have now gained monopoly power over the markets, sort of the influence and ways in which the workers can shape the market is really gone. Because they are, in order to get rights, they're sort of forced on being on the apps, and the apps completely determine how much a certain ride is going to cost. So they lost a certain level of sort of influence and bargaining power in their decision making. But I fully agree that it kind of sheds light on many different parts of the labor market that have been long ignored by governments and policymakers. And in some ways, of course, it offers a huge opportunity to regulate them, right? And maybe provide living wages to a range of workers that otherwise would remain sort of in informal economies and very much unprotected. So there's currently a huge deficit, but regulating such large companies that employ around the world millions of workers is an enormous opportunity to provide them with better lives and better living standards.
Yeah, I agree. So because the platform, they are centralizing fragmented markets, there's also a opportunity by via a platform or regulating platform have impacts on many workers that were probably before invisible. I think what you also mentioned is the problem of the power asymmetry between the worker and the platform, and also combined with the dependency, and also this optimization. We are talking about seamless experiences, but in the end, the optimization most of the times accounts for the client and not for the worker. And within a already precarious market, there needs some margin being created for the middleman, the platform, to make profits. So that's also have some discussable incentives of taking the wrong decisions and don't trust the markets blindly of fixing it, like many people sometimes stay. And you also just returned from Lebanon, where you also were looking to platform discussions. Can you give some more insights in your experience and observations over there?
Yeah, it was a really interesting trip where we interviewed a range of workers and also spoke with parts of the government, the labor ministry, and also other researchers and academics. And what's kind of striking is that there's very little research to date on the platform economy in Lebanon. Maybe just a sort of a handful of studies at the moment. And yet it's yet another country where we see a huge rise in platform work. And in part, it's a very interesting context where Lebanon had an enormous economic and financial crisis in 2019 with skyrocketing inflation, job loss, and sort of a very dysfunctioning social security system that didn't capture any of the workers. So you end up in a labor market, especially around platform work, where it's a very diverse pool of workers. Many of them sort of don't see or don't find jobs in the formal economy, which is also quite small in Lebanon, and sort of see platform work as their only opportunity. And it has been really growing quite enormously. And But again, sort of the lack of protections puts them in extremely precarious situations. And so from the conversations we've had with workers, I think there's sort of three things that really stand out. One is the decline in pay over time. So many of the workers we spoke with have been with some of the platform companies for just about a decade. And at the beginning had sort of very good earnings and did sort of well for themselves, but over time saw their pay more than half. When in some cases really now they maybe make a fifth of what they used to make. And it's very clear to them that part of the issue is that the platforms brought in more and more workers, with workers seeking sort of opportunities and not having any other jobs in the labor market. But also sort of this exploitative nature of companies now really sort of having a tight grip on the service, on the market, and now raising the prices for customers while dropping the pay for workers. So the pay and sort of the decrease in pay and the volatility really being an enormous factor. The second one is sort of the lack of social security and labor protections, where workers describing sort of this burden of paying for expenses related to their work, not having access to sick leave, but also the covering sort of the all the costs and expenses when it comes to accidents at work. And I'm happy to share maybe some of the stories that were really quite striking. Sort of the complete lack of responsibility that some of the companies take when workers are in sort of harm and an injury related to their work. And then the third one relates to the sort of this huge distance between the workers and the companies. No, sort of the sense that sort of the interest in communicating some of the frustrations that people have, maybe some of the negative experiences they've had to the companies, and the companies not being interested in listening to them or hearing any of these grievances. And I think that relates to the lack of bargaining power, the lack of sort of the ability and the protections to unionize and sort of form workers' collectives and pressuring companies to listen and also take on grievances. But the sort of extreme remote, you know, sort of divide between the companies and the workers. So I think those three issues were really quite striking. But then also the complete regulatory void, no, where there's currently no provision in labor law for platform work. So again, it's not unique to Lebanon, but we see it in so many different countries where the sort of these advances that have been made in tech and sort of using technologies in the labor market to organize work have not been met with the regulatory needs to protect workers.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And the last one, also a lack of enforcement, because I think in many cases there is good legislation, but if you don't enforce, then it's also quite worthless. So what you also mentioned, also that's the situation of the decline of pay over time. I think it's something that we see in almost all countries in the world going on, also because of the thresholds being lowered to start working. But yeah, the worker has no influence on the supply on the platform, so you know what your competition is. So you really have no influence in that. What was a story that really is still in your mind of when you interviewed one of the workers there?
So one of the perhaps most striking stories was the story of Abraham, who is a 74-year-old rideshare worker who has been working as a driver, as a professional driver for most of his life, previously for sort of car companies and rental car companies. And then in 2015, started working for a platform company. And he had, due to the Lebanon's very volatile and difficult economic situation, essentially lost all of his savings in the financial crisis, and has no access to a public pension. So there's no way for him to not work. And he said, I'm not hireable, right? But 70 years old, there's a lot of ageism and discrimination against older people in the labor market. He was not able to get another job. So he continues to drive for a platform company. And so not only can that be challenging on some days because he's not as, you know, he doesn't feel sort of particularly well every day, but also there was one situation where he had two customers in the car, one sitting beside him and the other one sitting behind him. And suddenly, well, he was completing the ride and suddenly he feels a knife on his throat. So the clients threatened him and said, you know, get out of the car, surrender your car and your belongings. So they took his phones, they took the car, ran off, and he sort of was left standing on the side of the road. He immediately went to the police, who sort of took down the notes and filed a report. He got in touch with the platform company, who responded very quickly, but then also said, you know, unfortunately, you know, there's nothing we can do for you because according to the service agreement that you signed, you are an independent contractor, you're responsible. It's sort of, you know, on your own account. And he was sort of very rigorous in even trying to identify who was behind the theft. He managed to get sort of a video recording of the incident from the supermarket he was parked in front of as the incident happened. But even with all that material, the company just entirely ignored his request and said, we have no responsibility here. And so this really left him in a situation of sort of trauma and shock with a lot of fear to go back to driving. He also didn't have a car, right? There was no fund or nothing that would help him get over that. So he essentially, through the help of his siblings and family, was ultimately able to get another car and bridge several months where he couldn't work just for psychological reasons and dealing with the trauma of the event, and then went back to driving. But he's, you know, sort of this extreme disappointment, but also the struggles he went through after being in a situation and not receiving any support or any help was quite life-changing, I would say, for him. I mean, there were sort of the ways in which he shared the story with us was, you know, very moving, and also sort of, you know, every day that he starts work is sort of a day where he has a lot of fear that maybe something will happen again and he doesn't know how he would react. So it's these circumstances really illustrate how the companies have created a model that sort of shifts all the cost and risk of doing business onto the workers and take away any responsibility from the company side when something goes wrong. And things go wrong. You know? It's in every company, in every sector, there's going to be risk, there's something that's going to happen. But companies take responsibility. You know? But in this case, we see that not being the case. So I would say that was quite a moving story that we heard.
Yes, I can imagine that. And it's a bit of crazy because those platforms, they centralize fragmented markets and then they profit from benefit of skill. But they can also, in the end, of course, use this benefit of skill of solving these kind of challenges and problems and accidents. Because in the end, maybe they can say, okay, legally, we don't need to do anything. But in the end, there's also something of doing the right thing. And I think it would be good also to think about it, how we can also use those benefits of skill also to maybe create a kind of a social fund or whatever, how to call them, to deal with situations that are maybe legally are not the responsibility, but more morally are, the logical thing to do when you care about people in debt. But yeah, I think it's a ongoing discussion within this topic. Mm-hmm. And if you look to pay of workers, so that's also a really important topic within your work. I think one example that I read was a research that you did and report the gig trap, algorithmic wage and labor exploitation in platform work in the US. I will also share the links also in the blogs and in the show notes of this podcast. Within this report about you calculated the average rate for gig workers in Texas, and in the end, the result was $5.12, which is extremely low. So can you give some more context about this research, and also how you also calculated in the end this rate? Because in the end, if there's one thing that especially the big brands are really good in, is of course hiding their numbers, unless it's of course for their own benefits to lobby on.
Yeah, thank you for raising that. This is a research that we engaged in for a couple of years in the state of Texas in the US. And as you alluded to, it's extremely difficult to have data about sort of the platform economy, right? Like due to the misclassification of workers, companies actually don't have any responsibility in sharing information and data about workers with the government. So even in places like the United States, which is a very data-rich country, there's essentially no or very little public information available about platform work. So this presented like a major challenge for us when we wanted to learn more about platform work and how much people are getting paid, and is it sort of in line with human rights requirements and obligations. So what we ended up having to do is run our own survey with platform workers to understand their financial situation a little bit better and also how much they're earning. And at first, in interviews we did with workers, we sort of, you know, we heard stories about financial precarity. The vast majority of the people we spoke with said they are struggling to make ends meet, falling behind on essential bills for housing, for utilities, even for food. And so we wanted to have a better understanding very concretely. So how much are people actually making? And so the way we wanted to understand it is to know how much people are making by hour, right? In part because in the US, the minimum wage is calculated at an hourly rate. And also because so many platform workers work extremely long hours and extremely long days to sort of reach an ultimate amount that they can, you know, that sort of then is sufficient to pay rent and expenses. But we try to learn how much people are making on average by hour. But that itself was actually very complicated because much of the time that people spend working for apps is also spent waiting. So in the case of Lebanon that we just talked about, with more workers in sort of hired by these companies and demand sort of similar or stagnant, at least not increasing, there's going to be less rides or orders offered to workers, right? So they're spending a lot of time just sort of sitting around and waiting for the next gig to come through. And that time is entirely uncompensated, because it's not considered sort of active working time by the companies. We, however, consider it working time because, you know, the people are not sort of enjoying leisure or doing other things, whether it's on their, whether it's on the motorcycle, on the bike, in the car, they're waiting for the next ride to come in. So in the survey, we therefore very meticulously analyzed also through screenshots and information shared by the workers, how much time they're engaged in and sort of active in, and then how much money people are receiving at the end of the day or at the end of a week or a month. And so doing that calculation, we found they made $16.90 per hour. So, but that amount is the amount before any expenses are taken into account. And in platform work, since people are categorized as independent contractors, they have to bring essentially their own work equipment. So they need to, let's say, in rideshare, they have to pay for the car, they have to pay for the car insurance, they need to have a phone plan that, you know, has enough data for all of these activities. Many also have to pay tolls and sort of fees to use the roads. Often, because they are in sort of, you know, not great street situations, they have to pay fines or tickets. So it ends up a very substantial amount that people have to pay for work-related expenses. In the survey we did, we found that about half of the cost, or half of what people earn, is going to expenses. But then we actually, in our calculations, also cross-checked it with a rate that the internal of the IRS, so basically the tax institution of the US, is using to calculate for independent contractors how much money per mile spent driving should be considered for expenses. So we're using a very official rate for each mile driven for expenses. So we found that from the $16.90 that people make an hour, actually more than half goes to expenses, and people ended up with sort of $7.53 an hour after sort of these, you know, costs of production are taken into account. And then we said, but wait a minute, people still are in situations that are not quite equitable to employees, right? And if we want to compare it to a minimum wage or a living wage, we have to go a step further. And we have to see if that worker was considered an employee in the same sector, how much, like, what are the type of benefits, sort of non-wage benefits, that they would be provided with. So we looked at especially taxi, food delivery, and sort of grocery shopping as private sector jobs in the US, and deducted those from the after expense amount. And that's how we ended up with the $5.12 an hour. That would be somewhat comparable to an employee. And that amount is below the federally agreed minimum wage, which is currently $7.25, which is, by the way, also extremely low. It's even further below what is considered a living wage for the state of Texas, which MIT puts at about $16.75. And it's even further below what some have proposed as a federal living wage in the state, which is about $17. So people really make extremely low pay. And again, like, that's the average. There were workers who said some days they essentially don't make any money at all, right? Because of the expenses, very little orders or rides coming in, and them essentially having to pay to work without making any money. So for so the average kind of masks the diversity that we see within that pay structure. And this is, and again, like, some people are probably making a lot more. So it's not to say that all workers are having extremely low pay, but many are. And what needs to be done is at least to provide an adequate floor that everybody has the right to, which is sort of agreed in international labor law. And this is sort of what we very much push for.
Yeah. I think it's interesting too. Also, what you also mentioned is that it also really differs per person. I think there's also research on Uber taxi drivers in Amsterdam, in the Netherlands, where you also saw that some of them, they make good money, most of them on average, but also quite a big group are really below average. So it also really differs on if you have the luxury of only, let's say, working via peak hour in peak hours or not. So it also really differs, of course, per person, but in the end, this the average of a bit more, a bit above $5 is of course crazy in that. And also those occupation related costs are also something that are quite a lot, I think, ignored in many discussions, because what you also mentioned, so the costs and risks that are normally are borne at the employer are now shifted to the individual worker, and they also need to be compensated for that. And that's also why minimum wages and living wages doesn't apply on self-employed gig workers or self-employed workers in general, which happens a lot in many official documents, is my experience in that.
And what I found really heartbreaking is that many workers, especially in when we did the research in Texas, kind of internalized the reason why they're paid so little. So what I'm trying to say, for instance, we spoke with workers who in grocery shopping, and some of them are also older people. And I remember we spoke with a woman who wasn't able to walk very fast, And so she, at the end of the day, she made very little money from through Instacart, and which is one of the big grocery shopping platforms in the US. And so when we talked through, you know, do you know why in this order you made so little? Why, you know, these pay structures? Do you understand the pay structures? She said, well, I think it's because I can't shop very fast, right? So if I could only walk faster, I would probably make more money. So essentially, this kind of is, you know, creates a situation of, you know, it's like capitalism on steroids, no? Where the value of the worker is sort of their pay is really determined how fast something can be done, and then how quickly money can be extracted from their labor. Mm. And so it has nothing to do with sort of, you know, equal pay, you know, good pay for the value of your work, but it really creates these horrible incentives for workers to put themselves also in very risky situations. Maybe one other example that probably you have heard of is also in India, where hundreds of thousands of workers have, in the last couple of weeks, gone on strike to protest something that is called a 10-minute delivery, where you can, let's say you are out of shampoo and you need this shampoo in 10 minutes. You can place this order and the app guarantees you that you have your shampoo within 10 minutes. Now you can imagine how difficult that is to comply with, right? Especially in many Indian cities, traffic is horrendous, streets are clogged. So the workers are essentially forced to break traffic rules and put themselves in extremely dangerous situations just to meet that window. And if they don't, they get punished by the algorithm. So it's at that point, it has really nothing to do with sort of safe and fair pay and sort of work structures, and everything to do with creating very unsafe working conditions for workers.
Mm. Yes, and I think it also creates a not a realistic expectation as clients. And I think in general, so consumers are probably the worst employers you can have, but they are getting even worse with those incentives of being promised within 10 minutes and then also punishing the worker with a bad rating when they don't arrive within this time limit, when the worker has no influence in many variables between the storehouse and the clients.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
And I think the other case I also want to discuss with you on the city level, that is also the case of the app delivery riders in New York, where in the end they also managed to get a minimum pay rate for app-based restaurant delivery workers. And that's also a case that you studied, as I'm right. Can you share some more information about that case?
Yeah, I think the New York case is a very sort of beautiful one of how collective action can lead to change and better protections, where it was specifically for food delivery workers who started organizing themselves to sort of discuss the issues and the challenges that they see in their work, but then also to push for change. But again, like they first found themselves in a situation where, you know, maybe they made some claims, they couldn't quite pinpoint, you know, how grave the issues were. So they decided to run their own study. So I think it was in 2020 or 2021, they ran a survey among food delivery workers to illustrate issues, again, with sort of safety equipment, around pay, the lack of social security. And they took the findings and presented it to the city council. And the city council said, okay, I take the point. We probably have to do our own study and investigation just for a sort of methodological rigor and transparency, which they then did. And they sort of, the research by the city government very much confirmed the findings of the workers of extremely low pay, lack of transparency, lack of data privacy, lack of safety protections, etc. And it took, so they took the study as then the background to introduce policy reforms. And they said, So in order to guarantee food delivery platform workers the minimum wage, which I think at the time was $15 an hour, we need to give workers at least, I think the rate was about like 25 or something, to account for the expenses, the lack of social security, and all of the things we discussed. So to account for the gap in the lack of protections. And they did. And so they slowly rolled out that minimum wage for platform workers. Of course, with a lot of pushback from companies, like threats of we will have to leave the city market, you know, we will run out of business. This is, you know, we can't work with this. Empty threats. I would say they're always still active in the city and probably still make a lot of profit. But it really made an enormous change in the lives of workers. There've since been a couple of studies by local groups that have shown that the average wage, of course, you know, went up enormously, that living conditions are better. And now also workers being able to maybe contribute into social security funds, et cetera, to then have certain protections in the face of accidents and injury. So there are ways in which governments have responded. Many of them have been sort of at the very local level, so in cities or states. We also see them at national, or in the case of the EU, even the sort of the cross-regional levels, which I think shows that there is a recognition that this is an issue that governments ought to pay attention to. And so now the question becomes, so what is the best way to regulate platform work, right? Do we have these like small or case-specific issues, whether it's around pay, whether it's around deactivation, whether it's around giving them the right to unionize, or do we address one of the bigger issues in the room, which is around misclassification, right? Which tends to be an extremely contentious topic.
Yeah, but in the end, with the city of New York, the response was not you should hire them as employees, but we're going to leverage it at via, in this case, pay.
That's right.
What's interesting.
Exactly. I think they couldn't go as far as addressing misclassification yet. No, I think there are attempts to address it. And I think that, like, these things are really they're very high level cases. In New Jersey, for instance, there are some policy proposals to address misclassification, which is so widespread in platform work. In California, you know, probably some of you may have heard of AB5 and sort of Prop 22, which was an attempt to address misclassification. The companies pushed back, and they created a referendum to have sort of the citizens decide how workers should be classified. And they ran, like, that ballot initiative, that referendum, turned into the most expensive one in U.S. history. So just to show that these are not sort of like little issues that, you know, some may not care about it. These are such high stake, and they're such high stake because it's not only about, you know, one service, you know, that may be provided. It's really about sort of the future of work, how work is going to be organized, the role of tech in the labor market, and how workers should be protected in that sort of new working environment. And unfortunately, with all that money, they made a difference, right? They won over the voters, and voters decided against misclassification. So, but I mean, that is still kind of playing out in court at the moment, but these are very live debates. And I think in New York, so with the new city administration, there are now other steps that the city government is taking to address also issues around deactivation, where workers are just being sort of pushed off platforms for often very obscure reasons, to also issues around wage theft, what happens to tips, are tips always being paid out to workers, what happens in terms of unemployment insurance, since companies don't pay into the insurance funds, which means that actually the government itself is losing out. They are not collecting the taxes that they could and should be collecting from these enormous, you know, multi-billion dollar companies due to misclassification. So I think step by step, even if it's not the immediate way to regulate platform work, I think there's a recognition that, you know, we can do things in the interim to improve conditions, but probably unless we fix some of the underlying issues, will continue to be a very sort of a slow process in making sure people gain all of the rights that they have.
Yes, agree. And I think I also in many cases in favor for the practical approach and see, okay, so how can you fix it within the current status of the contract? Also knowing that many platforms that are shifting, especially delivery and taxi, but mostly delivery platforms that are shifting to the employee model, they shift to subcontractor models, where in the end, the situation for the worker doesn't really improve, and in some cases also gets worse. And also discussion, of course, when a subcontractor provides workers to a platform, then the subcontractor, who is the employer officially, has no control because the platform is controlling the worker via the app. So I'm really also in favor of those practical things. Okay, so how can you fix it on different levels? Because then also the competition between the self-employed version and the employed version is also getting less unfair. And I also agree what you also mentioned about the Proposition 22. So in the end, it's also more a global approach and debate, because we also knew that what happened in California was also a kind of a blueprint they want to use at other places. Because I already knew, because in the Netherlands, I'm quite visible in the Dutch media. So when something happens, let's say with Uber, then the Uber lobbyist calls me with the question, oh, Martijn, you saw what happened. So do you want to have more context? And the nice thing about lobbyists, you know what their agenda is. So it's nice to have conversation, because you know when they're talking bullshit, you know why they're doing that. But also just the day after the Proposition 22 win, quote unquote, win for the platforms, I got a call from him saying, hey, Martijn, did you saw what happened there? What do you think? Is this also a good case for Netherlands? So you also knew they were investing this $200 million in this lobby campaign also to create a kind of a, for them, a best practice example they could also push everywhere in the world, which was interesting to see. Well, those platforms, they have a local impact. They also have a global strategy on how to advocate their interest in the debate. But I think what the New York case shows that in the end, it's also about priorities and political will. Because yes, we can change things, but yeah, there needs to be a kind of sense of urgency. That's what I also like about the European Platform Work Directive. And also what I also like about the platinum debates, because when I ask in Europe to people from the European Commission about, okay, now you have the Platform Work Directive, why didn't you advocate for all workers? Because when a, let's say, delivery rider or a taxi driver gets work via platform, there doesn't need to be a difference in the rights. So when you get the work via platform or via. And then say, Martijn, yes, you're right, but just advocating for a European labor market redesign is political suicide. And yeah, the discussion on platforms gave us the opportunity to pinpoint this discussion for this category of workers, and then we're going to discuss beyond the platform. So it's in the end, it's all about political will. Mm. And one question more, one last question also about the New York case, because there are, but also, of course, the Texas research, because there are always discussions when you're talking about pay, so what to include and what not. And I think one of the most discussed is always the waiting time, because the platform, they say, yeah, waiting time is a kind of an opportunity cost on the account for the worker. The worker, they have multiple apps open. So yeah, if you are calculating, if I need to pay for waiting time, then maybe five platforms are paying this, and then the worker has a really good salary. So we all know the discussion and the defense of platforms in the discussion. So do you know how this discussion on how to include waiting time and how to calculate, because it also really differs per day, per hour, per zip code area. So how do you look to discussion of this waiting time?
In a case of within, New York, yeah. It's a good question. I think there was a distinction between some of the major, so because many of the workers don't really, they're only multi-app to a certain degree. So they probably work 80-90% of their time for one app and then maybe add like a little bit from another. So it's depending on the sector and the jurisdiction, I think probably multi-apping is a bit overrated. I think they looked at it by, and also I have to say, you know, it's often presented as this like, oh, it's an issue we can solve. It's like so complicated. But these companies have, they have all the data. They can tell you exactly, you know, where a worker is at a given time, how long they have been waiting, what's the, you know, are they driving back from a certain delivery? Like what's the, so it's something that can be calculated, you know, if there's interest to do so. And if the data is also being shared. So I think at the moment, I would have to double check in New York how they handled it. But I think my understanding is that in part, the sort of this relatively high difference between the minimum wage and sort of the regular employment minimum wage of $15 and then the, you know, sort of the 25 plus that is provided to food delivery workers is to compensate for unpaid waiting time. So that is actually just for active. And it's something to confirm, but I think that's in order to account for the unpaid waiting time. But I think it's an issue that can absolutely be solved. No, and especially if the data was more provided to governments and policymakers, I think it's less of an issue than it's currently being portrayed as.
Yeah. Yeah, I always get suspicious when people say things are complicated, because I think in the end, you make it complicated when you don't want to do things. So one example is I'm also running a data portability service called GigCV, which is a kind of a academic project, a non-profit. It only costs money to facilitate a platform to share data with the workers in the form of a digital CV, so a resume. And when I rented this for a room with about 200 different lawyers, they all said, Martijn, that's complicated. And then, no. Because if you want to do it, it's really simple, because GigCV has some good legal contract, but it's just really basic stuff. So it's good contracts, but everybody can make them. But if you don't want it, then you make it complicated. And I think that's also the core in discussion always, that people when say it's complicated. The same also, let's say, on how the rates are being calculated for taxi drivers via platforms. It's nice. You always mentioned it has a ride sharing. I will just say taxi platform, because there's, from my perspective, there's no sharing involved within that. But they also saw that the calculation of, okay, so how much does a trip cost and what does the driver gets, also started really simple. Just okay, you have a starting tariff, maybe tariff per minute or per mile, and that's the rate, and there's the cut off the platform of X%, and then that was quite clear. But now nobody knows what the driver is getting and what the client is paying, so I think maybe also one solution could also be in that just simplify these kind of models, because the question is always, for what reason do you make things complex? And I think in the part, especially on the on-demand gig economy, many times it's just for the benefit of creating information asymmetry with some reason. But I think what I really like about the New York case is that in the end, though, the platform is with most of the times when they are paying by task, then they really benefit from an oversupply of workers on the platform, because the bill for the oversupply is on the individual worker. And when they need to pay per hour or have a certain rate per hour, then in the end, this cost shifts to the platform, where I think it also belongs. And there was also some quote I read somewhere, also around the New York case, that's from the department study, projects that the minimum pay rates will encourage apps to use workers' time more efficiently, increasing deliveries from 1.6 to 2.5 per hour. So I think it's also given a incentive to the platform to think about more efficiency on how to use the time of the worker being available more efficient in that case.
I enjoyed how Lina was able to explain the context in which developments in the gig economy are taking place in this episode. It is clear that the gig economy, and in particular the on-demand platforms for delivery and taxi services, are putting the rights of workers that have been thought of for over the past decades to the ultimate test. Lena clearly shows the elements that platforms bring to markets that were already largely precarious. These included reduced bargaining power, but also a reduction in autonomy and flexibility, which is at odds with the promise of many of those types of platforms. And although the debate is often quite abstract, it are the personal stories, such as that of the taxi driver Abraham in Lebanon, that show that the choices made have an impact on real people's lives. It's encouraging to see cases such as that of the city of New York, where real solutions can be created, as long as there is political will. And that political will and setting priorities at a global level is what the next episode will be about, when part 2 of this conversation will be published. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Also check our bi-weekly newsletter and online webinars on the global gig economy. You will find the links in the show notes.